brief sort of, if we zoom back out and try to look at what we were doing last time, what we were trying to do last time was give the rate of scattering of dark matter off of nuclei so that we could determine the rate in direct detection experiments. And the flow of logic was that we go from our dark matter quark interaction, which is what we call the fundamental theory, sometimes the ultraviolet theory. The idea is that most of our knowledge of particle physics is through high energy collisions, and so we typically write down our theory in terms of these degrees of freedom, but then the low energy degrees of freedom, the actual things that we're scattering off of, are bound states of the quarks. So what we need to do is map this interaction into an interaction involving nuclei. And the way that we did that was basically by putting in either certain fudge factors or by defining sort of new coefficients. So transforming an operator that of dark matter scattering off of quarks into an operator of dark matter scattering off of nucleons. And for the case of a spin-independent interaction, particularly for a vector interaction, you're counting the number of quarks inside of the nucleon. So, for instance, if you're talking about a proton, then you're scattering off of two ups and one down. And so they're going to be related to these coefficients by simply just counting them. Okay? And for a scalar interaction, as we showed in the tutorial, you're counting them and you're just giving them a slightly different weight to account for the fact that the hadronic physics for a scalar is a little messier. It doesn't just directly map them. But the point is that numerically, we have a way of taking this coefficient and using what we know about how quarks bind up into nucleons, we can map our interaction into a dark matter nucleon scattering interaction. And then what we want to do is map this into a nuclear process. And this is basically in the limit where you're just coherently scattering off of the different nucleons in the nucleus. You just count up the number of nucleons inside of N. And what you end up with, sorry, is that the matrix elements scale sort of like the total number of nucleons. So the cross-section is going to scale like the total number of nucleons squared. Okay? And for most nuclei, this number is much bigger than one. Okay? So we get this large enhancement from the fact that basically you're scattering, you're seeing the entire nucleus, and there's a possibility of scattering off of each of the individual nucleons, and so you have this large coherent enhancement. Okay. For the spin dependent, oops, it's a little bit more complicated. So the reason was that we started off with some other operator. So an example of this is the axial vector operator. And so what we found was that you still have something that's counting the contribution of the quarks inside the nucleons. But now what we found was that because this interaction scales like an axial vector, the sort of quark or the nucleon-level interaction that it's matching onto is something that involves the spin operator. So we found that it counts the contribution of the quark Q to the spin of the nucleon. Okay. So we had something that was like sort of A tilde just schematically, chi bar gamma mu gamma 5 Q, sorry, chi. And then we had nucleon, this spin operator. Okay. And we argue this just based on symmetry principles. And so what we want to do is we want to take this and we want to figure out how it goes to the dark matter nucleus interaction. And just by comparing it to the spin independent case, what it's going to look like is that how this matches onto the nucleus is going to be the contribution of N, the nucleon, to the nucleus spin. Okay? So it's basically completely analogous, except instead of here, what you're interacting with is basically proportional to the number of quarks in the nucleon and the number of nucleons in the nucleus. Here, what you're going to be proportional to is how much do these quarks affect the spin of the nucleon, and then how much do each of the nucleons affect the spin of the nucleus. Okay? And then in the tutorial, what you showed is that this is actually proportional to basically the spin of the nucleus. right? Because if the nucleus has no spin, then there's no net contribution to the spin, and so there's no net contribution to this dark matter, and so the rate actually scales like the eigenvalue of J squared. This the total angular. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's not hugely important. So, okay. So to be honest, I wouldn't get too bogged down in the calculational details of this, because in particular for the spin dependent, this is the real punchline that we want to get out of it, which is the rate scales like the square of the angular momentum of the nucleus instead of like the total number. So for instance, the reason why this is big is because if I take some large atom that I have a bunch of protons and a bunch of neutrons inside of the nucleus, now you can say, well, if I add a bunch of protons and neutrons into the nucleus, doesn't that also change the total spin? And we know that the answer to that is no, because spins like to anti-align with one another. Just because if you're trying to compress things into the ground state of the system, the Pauli exclusion principle tells us you can't have the same, you can't have two particles occupying the same quantum state. And so one way you can have a different quantum state but the same energy is by flipping the spins. So even if I have this gigantic nucleus, if all of the nucleon spins are anti-aligned, then the total spin is small. So this does not grow like the number of particles inside the nucleus. It's typically an order one number. Whereas this spin-independent cross-section, if I put a really big nucleus in my detector, then my cross-section is going to be hugely enhanced. Okay. So given our sort of limitations in time, the fact that you didn't really talk much about this in the tutorial, let's see. I might just finish the calculation that we were doing yesterday for this and then just move on, because the only thing that you really need to know is the fact that the cross-section for spin dependent is much smaller than the cross-section for spin independent. So what this means is that this gives you a very small signal in your detector. And so this is not really going to be very constrained by our direct detection experiments. It's getting to the point where you're starting to be a little bit constrained by them, but really the strongest constraints come from spin independent. So this is a very large signal, conceivably. And so depending on, so if you compute the, say, the thermal annihilation cross-section for both of these things, they're comparable at freeze-out for spin-independent and spin-dependent. But if I look at the rate that they're scattering my detector, they are very different, okay? So what this tells us is that direct detection is an excellent way of looking for dark matter, but it's an excellent way of looking for certain kinds of dark matter interactions, okay? So in principle, if I build an experiment and I don't see dark matter scattering in it, I can't exclude the possibility that there is some, that dark matter is annihilating through this, the thermal freeze-out mechanism, just because it could be interacting with normal matter in a way that essentially suppresses the interaction rate by some large number. Okay. So are there any questions sort of about the general idea? Yes.
So
I guess what I mean is that if you take this and you compute like sigma v for chi bar to qq bar, it's pretty much up to an order one number the same as if I took this, if the coefficients are the same. Okay. So the statement is just that for the annihilation process, you're not as sensitive. So there is some sensitivity to the Lorentz structure, but you end up with comparable kinds of rates for both of these things. But then when you look at what are the implications of her scattering off of nuclei in your detector, they're very different. And so what this is telling you is that your direct detection experiments are only probing some subset, say, of the possible interactions that can give you thermal freeze out. Okay. Okay, so we're considering the axial vector. Okay, and so the idea was that we had this interaction, AQ, Q bar gamma mu gamma 5Q, chi bar gamma mu gamma 5 chi. And what we wanted to do was take the matrix element of this thing in nucleus states. So there's an in-nucleus state, an out-nucleus state. And so what we don't know how we can express quark operators in a nucleus matrix element. So what we want to do is we want to convert this into an effective interaction in terms of the nuclei. Now, it's easily expressed in terms of, so the matrix element looks sort of like this. So this is something that, in terms of our, like the Feynman rules, we can just write in terms of like external spinner wave function. So this gives you something like u bar out, gamma mu, gamma 5 u in. So this is something that is just the same Feynman rules that we've always used for computing matrix elements. What we really care about is this piece. So we just defined a series of numerical quantities that you basically have to go out and either do an experiment to measure or are the results of a calculation of non-perturbative physics from lattice QCD. So we started with the quark going to a nucleon matrix element. So we had nucleon out, Q bar gamma mu gamma 5 nucleon in. This was equal to 2 delta Q nucleon times the corresponding thing in terms of nucleon operators. Except instead of a gamma mu gamma 5, we had this S mu operator. So this is basically the spin operator. And this just came from the fact that we needed it, you know, this side has an axial vector in it. We need another axial vector on the other side. And in terms of the non-relativistic expansion, I have some nucleus that's pretty much sitting at rest. The only possible axial vector is the spin vector. Okay. So this in some sense is just a numerically defined relation where we're writing down the quark interactions in terms of some, fudge factor times the nucleon interactions, okay? And this S mu operator in the non-relativistic limit was just 0 times the 3 vector for spin. Okay, so then what we wanted to do was we wanted to say, okay, well, I have my interaction in terms of nucleons, and I want to figure out what the matrix element is in terms of nucleus initial and final states. So what I really want is this. Okay. So I use this to say, well, this is just 2 delta Q for the nucleon, eta bar, S mu eta, doing a direct substitution. So now this is just a number, so it can come out of my matrix element. So what I really need to figure out is this. So this is basically the expectation value of the spin operator acting on nucleon states while I'm projecting onto a basis of nucleus states. Okay. So what we basically need to do is I have this nucleus, which is made up of some number z protons plus a number a minus z neutrons. And then these have some arrangement of spins. Okay. And then these have some arrangements of spins. So there's some average spin of the protons inside of my nucleus. There's some average spin of my neutrons inside the nucleus, and then these contribute to some total number. Okay. Yes, Tubra. So in a general frame, it comes from doing a boost transformation on this vector. Okay. That's right. That's right. So this is sort of an effective low energy description. But at least at zero momentum, we know that this is the only axial vector that we can put inside of this matrix element. And so that sort of fixes what this is in the non-relativistic limit. And then when you can just simply boost the system in order to find out what it is generally, okay? So it's a little bit tricky because by definition, parity is a symmetry that acts differently on the spatial and time coordinates. So, yes.
So when you go from, say, nucleons to the nucleus,
yes,
you're basically just counting, like assuming that the nucleus is, you've got lots of protons and neutrons, you just count each one separately.
Yes, that's right.
Whereas going from quarks to nucleons, can't do that. So what's different in the two cases?
So what's different is that it has to do with the characteristic size of the object. So nucleons are extremely small, and they're another way of saying that is that the binding force on them is extremely strong. Okay, so if we look at what causes nucleons to form, we start out with quarks and gluons, and these things are all just floating around freely. But at energies below this quantity lambda QCD, which is where the strong coupling goes to infinity, if I try to do perturbation theory with this, I see that I have to include an infinite number of diagrams because my coupling goes to infinity, so I can still formally talk about quarks and gluons, but any process actually involves an infinite number of them. And so what this tells you is that the bound state nucleon is a very complex combination of quarks and gluons. So if there's, so for instance, for the vector case, there was an easy correspondence because there was some conserved current, there was a symmetry that relates the quark gluon description and the low energy description, and that allows you to exactly determine it. But in general, we have absolutely no calculational control. So the best that we can do is we can say, well, I know that I have quarks and gluons in the high energy theory, and I know that I have protons and neutrons in the low energy theory, and then I just measure something that kind of is sensitive to the quark coupling, and that gives me some number, and that allows me to match the two of them. So this is a completely just a quantitative statement. There's no sort of fundamental physics that goes into this. For the nuclei binding into nucleons, however, there is a perturbative description of that, and that's in terms of what we call the chiral Lagrangian. So basically, you take your quark gluon theory, you match it into a theory of protons and neutrons and pions, essentially, and then I can compute things like, you know, proton, you know, scattering off of pions and all of this sort of thing. And this theory is actually perturbative. It's a strongly coupled theory in that the perturbative expansion isn't amazing, but it's still, there's some notion of perturbation theory. Perturbative. So for instance, the binding energies of nucleons inside of nuclei are of order MeV. So this is the, you know, nucleon in nucleus. This lambda QCD is of order few hundred MeV. So we can see that that this is a much higher energy, a much more tightly bound system. We have much less control over it. The actual scattering momentum transfer is somewhere in between these things. Okay, so that's sort of why we can, why we have to deal with this sort of quantitative way of understanding the quark hadron phase transition, but we can sort of treat nucleons as just a bunch of things that are grouped together that are interacting. I don't know if that answers your question at all. Yes.
When you try and make an effective Lagrangian, mm-hmm. you just make sure that your Lagrangian satisfies all the symmetries of the UV Lagrangian, right?
Yeah.
And you're pretty well guaranteed that it's going to work for all low energy processes.
That's right.
So maybe I misunderstood you, but if you said there's no symmetry that we're working with, in that particular case, how can you guarantee that that Lagrangian is actually true? Like, because you can match them for one process, but how do you know that same coupling is going to hold for all the processes?
So there are approximate symmetries that map on from one to the other. So for instance, there's this so-called isospin symmetry, which it's related to the SU2 gauge symmetry, but it basically tells you that your proton and neutron are nearly degenerate because the only thing that changes is a quark mass. So there are various things like that that allow us to classify the states in the low energy theory in terms of approximate sort of quark content of the high energy theory. There's also some, for instance, there's this chiral symmetry where if you set all the quark masses to zero, then there's an exact symmetry that's valid in both the UV and IR, and you can also use that to classify your particles. So there's definitely something special about like light quark hadronic states that allows us to sort of do these kinds of mappings. But I think that an answer to this is you take some state like an electron, say, or a neutrino that doesn't worry about any of this, and you know exactly what its high energy interactions are, and then you scatter it and you just see what happens in low energy theory. And so that gives you some window as how you can relate high energy theory interactions to low energy theory interactions. So just to reiterate, maybe a simpler way of saying all of this is that there's such a thing as a free proton. I can take a proton, I can pull it out of the atom, and it's just there, right? There's no such thing as a free quark. Because I pull a quark out, it's actually easier for the vacuum to pop out more quarks in order to bind them up into hadrons. So in some sense, you literally cannot talk about this as just adding together quarks, because there's no such thing as a quark in the low energy theory. Right, there is such a thing as a nucleon, it's just you don't often find it unbound. But you know, hydrogen is an unbound nucleon. So this is a sensible thing to do. Okay? So basically what this is sensitive to is the contribution of the proton and neutron spins to the nuclear spin. But they're weighted by these factors here. So they're weighted by the fact that if I interact, let's say I tune my coupling so that I'm only coupling to neutrons and not to protons, then it's only the neutron part of the spin that's going to give me some interaction with my dark matter. So the total nuclear spin is the sum of the proton and neutron spins, but the interaction is going to depend on how much I'm relatively coupling to protons and neutrons, and then how much each of those is contributing to the spin. So basically what we want is this quantity here, which is a nucleus matrix element of this spin operator. This is the spin operator for nucleons. Okay? And so we know that if I did not have these relative coefficients, that there would be some relationship between so if I didn't have sort of the relative interaction coefficients, then I know that adding my proton and neutron contributions is going to be proportional to this, which is the nucleus spin operator, okay? Because my nucleus is made up of a sum of protons and neutrons, and so my total nucleus spin is going to be some sum of my contributions of my proton to the nucleus spin and the contributions of the neutron to the nucleus spin, okay? So these things are related to one another in a way that can be measured. So in particular, these quantities can just be experimentally measured. Okay, and so what this allows me to do is I just define a quantity. Do this. Right, so this is basically going to be AQ delta Q. Sorry, it's hard to read in this corner, so I might write it over here. So basically, I define another numerical fudge factor. There's a lot of these in this field. Okay. So this is the numerical factor that relates my QQ bar interaction with the proton spin. Okay. So this is just N T bar S U T N plus the Q okay. This is just going to be defined to be equal to some constant times the total nuclear spin. So the idea is that there's some relationship between the contributions of the proton to the nucleus and the total spin of the nucleus. And the thing that I'm interacting with is has some relative weights associated with how I'm... this is AQ, yeah. So there's this factor that converts my interaction between quarks and protons, and this factor that converts my interaction between quarks and neutrons. And so the relative contribution of these things is going to add to tell me what the, to give a relationship to the total nuclear spin. Okay. So once again, this is just a phenomenological relationship. There's nothing fundamental about this. And it turns out that you can express this lambda just from sum of angular momentum to 1 over j, where this is the spin eigenstate of the nucleus. Okay. Times this coefficient. So this is technically summing over all of the different quark contributions. So what we're going to do is we're going to sum over the quarks. AQ delta Q proton. Neutron. Okay, so basically what you do is you go out, you experimentally measure how much the proton contributes to the nuclear spin, how much the neutron contributes to the nuclear spin for a particular atom. So this is nucleus dependent. And then what this allows me to do is it allows me to convert this factor in my cross section into something that just involves the total nuclear spin. Okay. Okay. So assembling all of this together, what you essentially end up with is the fact that, you know, when we do all of the steps, there's going to be a whole bunch of factors here, but then you're going to end up with something that's proportional to the nucleus spin. The average nucleus spin. Okay. And so this is something that you show in your tutorial, and if you want to do it in your free time, you don't have to. If we compute what the differential cross section is, we essentially end up with this matrix element squared. This is, of course, contracted into some other object, yes.
By J. So are we not just defining lambda to be the thing we're looking for? Up to some factor, up to dividing by J. And I mean, seems like.
So.
Why? I mean, why would we bother going through this? Why not just calculate? If we can calculate lambda, can't we just calculate the thing?
So you're right, we do want to calculate. Sorry. Yes. No. Well, so the point is that, sorry. So when I say we can calculate lambda, I mean that we can calculate, what we can do is we can substitute all of this, maybe I put an extra.
Are you looking for my expression that looks like it'd be easier to calculate what we substitute here than to calculate lambda? So if it's going to put a separate lambda, you need to calculate J as well.
Right. So I think the point is that we want to Okay, so here's the difference. So what we're going to use is we're going to substitute this. So I think that I was being perhaps a little bit free and easy with the notation. So let's see. So lambda is something that's going to end up being in our final cross section. The point is that wait, is this? Ah, I see. Okay. So I think that a difference is that, so for this thing that we originally had for our cross section, this is for the state where we start with a nucleus at rest and then we're scattering out. So I think the point is that,
I thought the idea of lambda was that we were trying to pull out all the stuff that wasn't spin dependent.
And lambda has a dependence on
exactly.
That.
Exactly, that's what I was.
Yeah.
Like it seems a little bit odd to say that, okay, so we're going to have something times the matrix element of the spin operator.
Yeah.
And then in the definition of your coefficient of that, include matrix elements of the spin operator. Like, I don't know.
Right.
Because it also doesn't really make sense because it's a vector on the right hand side. And I think it's just this. I think the coordinate equation is just that we're using lambda as shorthand for the, well, again, you know, by Lorentz invariance of everything, we know that this complicated sum that we're interested in is proportional to a matrix element of the total spin operator.
For sure. And then there's something
over it. Yeah. So I think that this thing actually is without the relative coefficient weightings for the A's. Yeah. I think that I miscopied those. So.
If lambda is a constant, then you can draw conclusions for that she said it's proportional to spin. But if lambda depends on spin, then you have no, you can't make, like, if lambda is defined as that, it's just going to, the spins are just going to cancel. Because that S is going to be basically J. And then J constant. Yeah, so it's going to cancel the J. J constant, and then that equation.
So, okay. I think I can answer your question. Like I said, I think I was being a little bit too free and easy with the notation. So what we really want to do is we want to, so for instance, so these are things that in principle we have to measure, but of course, as Ross pointed out, we're not measuring the contribution from the four vector spin operator, right? Really what you typically do is you compute, say, the expectation value of n in the j, MJ state of say P bar, like, you know, S P nucleon J MJ. Okay. So experimentally, what you're actually measuring is this quantity, which is N J MJ equals J. Of P bar S Z P N J MJ equals J. So what I'm basically doing is I'm computing the expectation value of this contribution of the proton spin to the spin in the Z direction when it's in the M state where it's in the highest possible spin state, right? So remember we have M can go from minus J up to J. So the thing that we're actually measuring is the expectation value of a nucleon in some particular angular momentum state for the z direction of the spin operator. Okay. So the point is that, so this is just a number. And so what this tells us is we can use this equation and plug in mu equals z. Okay? And so what this tells us is that sum of AQ AQ delta Q N J MJ equals J P bar SZ. Okay, then plus the corresponding neutron term. So I'm just going to call this JJ. Okay, so then this whole thing is going to be equal to lambda expectation value of n j j z j j. Okay. Now this is just j because I have the sz operator and it's in an eigenstate of the sz operator with eigenvalue j. So this just gives me j lambda. So now I can express my lambda in terms of expectation values from this particular angular momentum state. Okay. So this is something that you actually observe. So this is, you know, I can prepare n in the j, j state, and I can observe it. And the point is that this lambda is the same for all of these different spin components. Okay, that's the key thing, is that you're making one observation which fixes this value of lambda, and that comes from the SZ measurement. Then when we plug it in here, this actually tells us the total sum of these matrix elements in terms of the arbitrary vector can be written as lambda times the spin operator. Okay, sorry. This is what happens when I don't put all of the indices in my notes. Okay. But the moral of the story is that after going through this whole thing, we end up with this operator squared. And if you look through the derivation in the tutorial, basically when you square this matrix element, you end up with something that's like the expectation value of j squared. Okay. Which isn't surprising. We have something that goes like j, you square it. This particular form, maybe it's not exactly obvious how you get it, but it's only off by a factor of j from what j squared is. Okay, so this is the spin-dependent interaction cross-section. And so what we end up with are these two qualitatively different kinds of scattering, where if I'm scattering through an axial vector, or you can show that you end up with something similar for the pseudo-scalar, that the dark matter interaction is proportional to the total spin of the nucleus. And if you're scattering through a scalar or a vector operator, then what you're coupling to is the total number of nucleons in the nucleus. Okay. So what are the implications for this? Okay. So in order to understand what the implications of this are, we need to know a little bit about what these experiments look like, what they're looking for. So the basic idea was we had our chunk of stuff. We had dark matter coming in, dark matter coming out. And what we were looking for was this nuclear recoil, this nucleus that the dark matter scatters off of. Okay. So what do we actually see? Well, a nucleus is a very small thing. We don't actually see the nucleus moving, okay? So what typically happens is that, you know, here's the nucleus moving, and then you have a bunch of other nuclei in the vicinity. So this nucleus smashes into all of the other nuclei, and this leads to various things. It leads to ionization of the electrons that are bound to these other atoms. If there's a crystal structure, it can lead to phonons because you're smacking into other nuclei that are in some lattice, say, and that ripples out and causes waves to propagate through the material. It leads to the emission of light, or you know, X-rays or photons or whatever. Again, just because you're exciting and you're de-exciting all kinds of atomic transitions, various energy levels of the electrons, etc. So what you do is you set up detectors all around your experiment, and you look for, say, the photons that come from this. You look for vibrations of the material. You look for all of these different signatures. Okay. Now, the problem with this is that there are a lot of other things in the world that do this. So basically, it's a very busy environment. So for instance, if I'm not careful, there can be radioactive elements. When they decay, they emit high energy photons, say, or other nuclei that then bump into other things and cause exactly the same signature that you expect. We have cosmic rays. So we have high energy gamma rays and charged particles and nuclei that are coming from outer space that come in and can hit my detector. So what we need to do is we need to find a way to separate out all the noise, essentially, all the background. Okay. And today, the leading experiments are with xenon. Okay, why xenon? Well, xenon, you can get to a very high radio purity. Okay? It's in a liquid phase, and a gaseous phase, which we'll see can be very useful for detection. And it has mass number of about 130. So this means that if I have a spin-independent process, this gets about a factor of 4 boost over the nucleon cross-section. Whoops. Okay, so what the experiment looks like is it's a big tank of xenon. And it's divided up into 2 phases. There's a gas phase and a liquid phase. And collisions lead to prompt photons. So basically just light emitted from the collision. And it also leads to ionization. So charged particles. So what they do is they apply some electric fields. So my WIMP comes in and scatters. And so I produce a bunch of light. So I'll denote that by these squiggly lines. So this light travels at the speed of light up to the top of the detector. And so what you do is you put a bunch of photomultiplier tubes up at the top, and you look for little flashes of light. Okay. So this is the signature of the prompt photons. Then what you do is you also produce all of these electrons from ionization. And all of the electrons slowly drift in the electric field. And then right at the very end, they apply a very strong electric field so that they smash these electrons into the gas. And that releases a whole new set of photons. So we have these sort of prompt photons and secondary photons. But what's crucial is that there's a timing difference associated with them, that the ionization photons are proportional to the electric field that you apply. So basically, you produce a lot of low energy electrons that sort of drift. And then their photons hit at a much later time. So if you plot the sort of what the light looks like as a function of time, if there's a collision, you see this flash, and then you see another flash at a later time. And they call this S1, and they call this S2. And the point is that you have a lot of information in this. You have the relative heights of the peaks. You have the time between the flashes. And using this information, you can use it to discriminate against other things that are coming and messing with your detector. So other electrons that happen to pass through and get flashes of light, the kinematics of the collision are very different than a nucleus coming and hitting another nucleus. And so what you'll see is you'll see only an S1, or you'll see only an S2, or you'll see different ratios of these heights, but you won't actually see this very distinctive pattern, okay, which only comes from some heavy thing barreling in and hitting your nucleus. Yes, Tubra.
Would have a directional preference, right?
That's right. So cosmic rays have a directional preference. They also put a veto, so they have an active veto. So basically, only this inner region of the detector is active. If anything scatters off of the outside of the detector, it's assumed to be a cosmic ray. The point being that 99% of your cosmic rays will be intercepted as they're coming through, if they're charged, in the very outer regions, whereas the dark matter doesn't really care if it's the outer region or the inner region. And so it's very efficient to put in this veto. And then finally, they put these things deep underground, like several kilometers underground. So you're already killing off most of your rates. And so quite remarkably, some of these experiments actually predict no background events, or very, very few background events. So you take this hunk of several hundred kilograms and you run it for a year and you expect to see nothing. They're very remarkable experiments. Okay? So this is one example, but there are other elements that you can use. So the other elements that people use, germanium, silicon, sodium, iodine. And the reason why you use different ones is because they have different ratios of the total mass to the total spin to other properties. So there are some dark matter candidates that interact with the magnetic moment of the nucleus or whatever. So different experiments use different things in an attempt to provide some independent probe. Now the problem with this is that we have, I have lots of different WIMP theories. And I have lots of different elements. How do I compare the results of any of these experiments? Because if I go, I generally have some complicated d sigma de recoil that's different for each WIMP candidate. And it might scatter differently off of different nuclei because they have different numbers of protons, different numbers of neutrons, different mass number, different spin. So it's a very non-trivial thing to figure out, you know, how do we assemble all of this information so that we can actually say something about what we are or are not seeing. And so the current methods are not ideal, but they're conventional at this point, and it's an active area of research to find better ways that kind of remove some of the model dependence of what I'm going to show you. But what I'm going to show you is just the conventional thing, and it will allow you to look at a paper that's a direct detection experiment paper and be able to say, okay, what kinds of WIMPs am I excluding or not? So what we do is we define, we'll call a standard 0 momentum cross-section. So this is just the convention that everybody uses. And I basically integrate from 0 to 4 times the reduced mass squared times the velocity squared, dq squared, d sigma dq squared, at q squared equals 0. Okay, so I'm basically saying I'm going to remove the, I'm basically going to take the limit of small energy recoil, and I'm going to do this integral. So this allows me to just express sigma not as a function of e recoil, but now sigma is just going to be a function of the reduced mass of basically just your physical parameters. It's not a function of anything kinematic. Now, this isn't quite useful because let's say that you don't scatter at low E recoil, but you actually have a larger scattering at higher E recoil. This totally screws that up. Okay? But this is a number that can be used to compare to experiments. And so at the very least, this gives you sort of an order one approximation to what you expect. Okay? So this basically, because we're at low momentum transfer, remember, this is exactly where we were seeing, you know, the dark matter is scattering off of the nucleus as a whole, and so you're coherently summing over all of the contributions. So this is dominated by coherent scattering. And again, if you want to be super careful, you can go and actually just integrate d-sigma de recoil for your favorite experiment and plug in the parameters and compare it to like their actual event rates. But the problem with that is that each experiment, you know, they throw away a certain fraction of their events. They have their complicated input. So this allows you to do a very quick and dirty estimate. Okay, so then we take our standard cross-section. And we convert it into an effective dark matter nucleon cross-section. Now you may think, wait a minute, we're going backwards. Because if you look at the top board, we're going from quark to nucleon to nucleus. And now we're going to go from nucleus back to nucleon. Okay, but this is a very crude way of taking the total cross-section and moving back to the nucleon cross-section. And again, this is totally a matter of convention. There's nothing particularly physics-y about this. This is just a convenient way of defining these things. Okay? And the reason why we want a dark matter nucleon cross-section is that, let's say I'm comparing a rate in an experiment with A equals 100 to an experiment with rate A equals 15. They're going to be hugely different for something that's spin independent. Okay? This one's going to scale like a squared, which is 10 to the 4. This one's going to scale like 15 squared, which is, you know, about 10 to the 2. And so when I'm comparing the outcomes of those experiments, I want to divide by a squared for a spin independent cross section so that I basically am comparing apples to apples. Okay? But again, this is a very crude way of doing it. Okay? So for spin independent, you define this as 1 over a squared, reduced mass of the proton squared over the reduced mass of the nucleus squared, sigma bar. Okay. So this is that sigma bar over there. So what this gives me is a number. And all experiments will constrain this number. So as sort of the quickest and dirtiest estimate we could do is we can take our cross-section, integrate it, find that value, and then this gives us something that I can just look up. Okay? And what you end up with is something that looks like this. Well, actually, so before I do that, I'm just going to tell you what the cross-section is for, say, so we had looked at thermal freeze out through this process, where you go through, say, Z to FF bar. Okay. So if I write out my sigma naught, it ends up being something like kappa squared, reduced mass of the proton squared, a squared over pi, Z of 2b up plus b down. And then if I assume chi has standard model neutrino-like couplings, I can just plug in the numbers. And what I end up with is, so this just gives me some benchmark number to aim for. So it gives me something that's about 10 to the minus 11 GeV to the minus 2. And if I insert appropriate factors of C and H bar, I can convert this into a cross-section in centimeters squared, which is about 2 times 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared. So the first thing to note about this is that this cross-section per nucleon is a little bit smaller than the thermal cross-section. Remember that our thermal cross-section was like, to get the correct abundance is about 2 times 10 to the minus 9. So we're already. So let's see what's going on here. Well, they'll yell at me if I put it together wrong. Okay. So this, so for the correct thermal cross-section, this was what we wanted for omega chi is equal to omega dark matter. So we already see that there are some small differences between the kinds of cross-sections that we get in direct detection experiments and the kinds of cross-sections you get from the thermal relic. So this isn't an exact one-to-one mapping, but you see they're sort of within an order of magnitude or two. So the fact that we have a thermal relic is giving us a ballpark to shoot for our direct detection experiments. Okay? But as we've seen, if we interact through something that's spin dependent, then our bounds get substantially weaker. Okay? So how well does this do? So for xenon, so these numbers are for xenon, which has an atomic number of 54 and a mass number of 131. Okay, and the constraints look something like this. So they constrain the sigma naught for spin independent. This is in centimeters squared. Here's the dark matter mass in GeV. And the scale goes something like 10, 100, 1,000. And the constraint looks something like this. Sort of ugly. So basically, all of this area in here is ruled out. And now let's write down the numbers here. This is about 10 to the minus 45, 10 to the minus 44, 10 to the minus 43. So if we compare, our prediction was about 10 to the minus 39. And in the WIMP region, we're excluding between 10 to the minus 43 and 10 to the minus 45. So this means that this is completely ruled out by like 7 orders of magnitude or something like that. Okay? Just from the fact that if you had this interaction for thermal freeze-out, you would have seen so many events in your direct detection experiments because they're so clean, they're so good, that basically this entire region of parameter space is completely gone. Now, the constraints get weaker at low mass. So the reason here is that the mass is smaller, and so the energy with which you're colliding with the nucleus is smaller. And at a certain point, your nuclear recoil is just too small to see. So this is the problem for looking for masses below about 10 GeV. So the constraints become much weaker up here. Here, what we find is that sigma naught is actually independent of m chi. If I look at this when I calculate it, there's no m chis that show up here anywhere. This reduced mass is basically the mass of the proton. But my number density of chi goes like 1 over the mass, or the energy density of chi. Well, maybe I don't write number density. Sorry. My number density goes like 1 over m chi because I know what my dark matter total energy is. And if I make dark matter heavier, then I need fewer of them to explain the CMB or all of my other observations. And so what happens is that I just start to lose sensitivity because there are very few dark matter particles that can scatter my detector. Just that they become more dilute. So what you can see here is that the most naive interpretations of the thermal freeze-out are already very strongly constrained by these kinds of interactions. Now, for spin-dependent, I'm running out of time, and so I won't draw it, except it looks almost exactly the same as this, except the numbers are like in the 10 to the minus 39 range, okay, for what's excluded. So the spin-dependent bounds are about 6 orders of magnitude weaker. And the reason is just exactly what we were talking about, that for spin independent, you have this enhancement where you're scattering off of big nuclei, your rates got really big. For spin dependent, you don't have that, and so you're not really ruling out many of your favorite candidates yet.
It seems a bit high, because I mean, the big number comes from A squared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the problem, so I think the problem is that this thing can all be a little bit smaller than one sometimes, the expectation value of J squared. The other thing is that Lux, so this is actually the experiment Lux. They haven't released spin-dependent bounds yet. it's a harder analysis to do and it's less constraining. So probably it will go down to between 4 and 5 orders of magnitude weaker. But it doesn't take much to tweak this to get it, you know, both down or up by an order of magnitude. So so what this tells you is that if you're scattering through a vector interaction, as long as it's an axial vector, so that you have a spin-dependent coupling, it's okay. But if you're scattering through a spin-independent interaction, it's not okay. It's completely excluded. Okay. And so it turns out the direct detection basically puts some of the strongest constraints that we have on dark matter, that we're looking for it exactly where we would expect to see it, and we just don't see anything. And Tibor brought up, I think, a few lectures ago, you know, well, how do we know anything about the dark matter profile? You know, its number density, its velocity. But you need to change its properties by like 6 orders of magnitude from what we expect them to be. So unless we are very unlucky and we happen to be living right in some local underdense region or something, very underdense, then these basically rule out anything that gives you a large spin-independent coupling to nucleons. Okay, Ryan.
Like, just looking at that graph, it looks like it increases with.
Oh, sorry. So this is the bound on sigma naught?
Oh, okay.
Okay. So the point is that my experiment just counts scatters. You know, I put it and I just wait, okay? But if I have 10 times less dark matter, I expect 10 times less scatter. And if you look at the expressions for the rates, there's dr, dE recoil, was basically proportional to n chi times d sigma dE recoil. So this is independent of mass. This is not independent of mass. And so the total rate that I'm observing in my detector is going to be smaller. Okay. So this more or less sums up the current state of affairs with direct detection. I think the take-home messages are that the WIMP scenario is being well tested by these kinds of experiments. They expect this to go down by another order of magnitude or two in the current round of experiments. And so, however, the bounds are very dependent on the Lorentz structure of your interaction. And so basically, if you want to have thermal WIMP dark matter, you need to make sure it doesn't have a spin-independent coupling. Okay. Are there any questions about this? We're wrapping up. Yeah, so this was the favorite thing up until maybe 10 years ago to 5 years ago, and then people said, oh, it's ruled out. Okay, I'm just going to shift this down here. The problem is that if you have lighter dark matter, then you typically need to have a larger annihilation cross-section. Or rather, it's harder to have the thermal annihilation cross-section while not violating other constraints, right? Because if I have a 10 GeV particle and it's annihilating through a 10 GeV mediator, you can ask, well, I've been doing experiments at 10 GeV for 40 years or 30 years. Why have I not seen this mediator? Like, so then you have to start playing games with, you know, how do I satisfy other constraints from, say, beam dump experiments or B-physics experiments or low energy collider experiments. But there's nothing a priori wrong with that. It's just, if you really believe that dark matter is related to like the weak scale in the sense of its mass is comparable to the Higgs mass, then this range is very, very strongly ruled out by direct detection. Okay, I think you can erase that.